I was just thinking before we got going here in class that I actually started teaching this class back in 1974. So it's a little more than 37 years. I was in my 20s, by the way. Yeah, I was really kind of depressed this week because I went online and discovered, because, you know, what this class has all been about is how do we go about establishing which of all the different religious options that are out there and non-religious options that are out there is the one that really stands up to sound evidences. And I was disappointed to discover that somebody on the web has actually reduced this to a single page. So here's 37 years of my life all done on one single page. So, and I have to distribute this to you, so we'll get some of these copies out to you. How to go about establishing which faith is true, all on one page. So, you quickly figure out it all depends on what you want to eat. That's a joke, okay. But yeah, on one page you can figure out how to choose your faith. All right. Well, a quick announcement before I get going today is that I do have to catch a plane to get up to Reading this afternoon. So I'm going to end this class right on the nose at 12:30 and I'm out of here. So just if you want to talk, there's a number of people you can talk to here. I mean, several people here that actually led the class. Feel free to talk to them. But if you got some questions, please interrupt me while I go through this lesson. And let me just kind of wrap up, because I kind of opened up a hornet's nest last week, and let me see if I can kind of bring some closure to that, and then move on to our topic of human origins in the context of Psalm 139, the creation psalm that deals specifically with human origins. And, you know, it's interesting that we are experiencing this year a repeat of what we saw last year, which is very severe winters over almost all of Europe. And an abnormally warm winter here in the U.S., that's if you define the U.S. as the lower 48. Just like last year, Alaska is having a very severe winter. But where it's being particularly warm in the north is over the Arctic. And so if you look at the polar ice cap, just like last year, it is abnormally warm. Matter of fact, in just in my lifetime, the polar ice cap has shrunk to less than half the size that it was. And so, and incidentally, the reason why I'm sharing with you all this is that our best global warming models predict that that's exactly what would happen with global warming. That you're going to get severe winters in Europe. It's going to be abnormally warm in the U.S. during the wintertime. And it's going to be drier in certain parts of the U.S. Alaska is going to be colder, and the Arctic will be a lot warmer. And actually predicts that the Arctic ice cap will actually completely melt away. And at least for the last couple of years, that's been exactly consistent with the weather patterns that we have seen. And, you know, we've been talking about fossil fuels and, you know, kind of the core of the global warming argument from the standpoint that it's all our fault is that we're burning up all these fossil fuels. And that's putting greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, both water vapor and carbon dioxide. This is what's warming up our planet. But you've heard me say here before that if you're going to blame human beings, actually, the burning of fossil fuels would rank third in terms of all of our human activities that contribute to global warming. And so we're really tackling the least of our problems, not the worst of our problems. Matter of fact, I would argue it probably ranks fourth on the list of things that we have done to contribute to global warming. At the very top of the list are all the cattle that we've bred. And the fact is that cows especially, but to a lesser degree sheep and goats as well, emit greenhouse gases. And because we've multiplied them up to such a great degree, both in terms of body mass and in terms of just pure numbers and the way we've bred them, they're far more efficient emitters of carbon dioxide and methane than they were when Adam and Eve showed up here on planet Earth. And the second biggest cause of human-induced global warming are all the forests we've cut down to make pasture lands for our cattle. Number three would be the deserts that we have greatly enlarged. The fact that the Sahara Desert is now 10 times the size that it was in the days of Julius Caesar, and the Gobi Desert about 4 times bigger than it was in the days of Julius Caesar. And the Gobi Desert is growing quite rapidly. The Sahara Desert has slowed down. But I remember when I was in my 20s and 30s, the Sahara Desert was advancing southward at a rate of about 6 miles per year. That's a very rapid growth of desert. And they've now slowing it down a little bit. But now we have a problem with the Gobi Desert, and the Gobi Desert has now reached the suburbs of Beijing. So it used to be hundreds of miles away from Beijing. Now it's actually into the suburbs of the city itself. All because humans have stripped the desert edge of vegetation, predominantly for cooking fuel, and consequently the desert got bigger and bigger. But what I was mentioning last week is that there's something that we could exploit that could very quickly bring about a very severe global warming crisis, and that would be these things that we call clathrates. And the clathrates, if you were not here last week, are basically burnable ice. It's water that crystallizes with methane, either in a frozen form or in a high-pressure state. And so we find these clathrates, methane hydrates, in places where it's permanently cold. So underneath permafrost in Siberia and Canada and Alaska, you'll find huge quantities of these methane hydrates. And it's stable because it's kept at a very cold temperature. And then another place you'll find them is offshore all over the world. And that's because there you've got high enough pressures so that these methane hydrates can form. They either need high pressure or a cold temperature. And the reason why you don't find them in the deep oceans is that you need a biological source to get the methane that you need to form these clathrates. And so you get that from ocean life on what's called the shelves of the continents. That's where you get the greatest abundance of ocean life, is on the continental shelves. Then, of course, you get runoff of biological material from the continents itself. So literally around all the continents, you have these clathrate deposits. Now, this map here simply shows you where they found them so far. And most scientists believe that you're going to find these methane clathrate deposits literally around all the continental shelves. It's just that we haven't looked everywhere. So you notice in Africa, they've only found one deposit. But the belief is, if we look, we're going to find it all around Africa, all around Asia. We'll find it around Australia and other places as well. And likewise, wherever it's cold enough, we're going to find it. We just haven't looked everywhere. You notice they've done quite a bit of exploration in northern Canada, but not a lot in Siberia. So the belief is that we're going to find a lot more of this stuff in Siberia. And that explains why the estimates for the total deposits of this stuff vary over such a great degree. And I gave you the numbers last week. If you add up all the coal, oil, natural gas, and every conceivable resource on the planet, not just the stuff that's economic to mine, but literally everything, that would include the shales, the tar sands, the stuff that's deep under the ocean, add it all up, it works out to a pre-industrial revolution resource of 60 to 80 trillion barrels of oil equivalent. But if we look at these clathrates, the low estimate is that it's 1,350 trillion barrels of oil equivalent. And the high estimate is that it's 500,000 trillion barrels of oil equivalent. So it's far beyond all the rest of the fossil fuels combined, which is why a number of people have said we do not have an energy crisis, because if we can tap into these clathrates, it's virtually a limitless supply of fossil fuels. Well, that's an exaggeration. It is a limited supply. After all, it took 3.5 billion years of life to build that stuff up. And so if you keep mining it, you will eventually exhaust it. And the thing we've noticed about human industrial activity, if there's lots of cheap energy available, it seems to foster more economic growth. But again, it's far beyond, by orders of magnitude, literally all the conceivable deposits of coal, oil, and natural gas combined. There's a pile of this stuff. So why aren't we using it? They've yet to find an economic, safe way to mine this stuff. How deep is it? Some places it's not deep at all. Well, the problem is how to get the methane out of the ice so that it's competitive with our other fossil fuel deposits, and to do it in such a way that you don't cause an ecological disaster. I mean, an easy way to get this stuff is just to warm up the Arctic, right? That will cause all the methane to be released from these clathrates. But the problem is it's going to be very difficult to capture all that methane. The vast majority of it will go up into the atmosphere, which would cause an almost immediate ecological crisis for the entire planet. And so there's a lot of people saying, yes, this stuff exists in great abundance. We're best off not touching it, because if we try to mine it, we're probably going to have an accident that will be utterly catastrophic. Okay, where the stuff exists, it exists below the permafrost in the Arctic, and it exists off the continental shelves of all the continents of the Earth. And yes, all you got to do is drill a hole down there, and you can, exploit this stuff, but you dare not have it released to the atmosphere. And that's the trick, to mine it without it being released to the atmosphere, and to mine it in such a way that it's actually an economic source of energy. So you got to find some way of capturing the methane before it gets to the atmosphere, and you got to find some way of getting it to the market at a cost-effective price.
Is this the kind of thing that universities let scholars that are, real into researching everything work on?
That's exactly what's happening. Universities around the world are studying what's called the clathrate problem. Mm-hmm. How do we mine this stuff? I mean, as I told you last week, you can get a block of ice of this methane clathrate, and you could actually put it in a furnace and it'll burn. So it's like putting a log on the fire.
But once you get it to market, you burn methane. Isn't that bad news?
Well, if you burn methane efficiently, it'll go to carbon dioxide and water. Which are considered safe residue gases.
Carbon dioxide is considered safe.
Well, I mean, it is a greenhouse gas.
It has the least CO2 of all the fossil fuels.
Pardon me?
It has the least carbon load of all the fossil fuels.
That's true.
It's by far superior.
Yeah, because you've got one carbon atom and four hydrogen atoms, and you're burning all of them. So, yeah, people have made that point. You're better off burning that stuff in terms of global warming than you are coal or oil. Moreover, there's no sulfur to worry about. It's just carbon and hydrogen. And so the end products are water and carbon dioxide. So, yeah, it's a clean fuel in that sense. But the problem is, if you start mining this stuff, you could wind up with an accident that could be real problematic. Yes?
Since you said the Arctic is warming up and melting and all that, couldn't it melt this stuff?
Well, that's a real concern. Is that, as the planet continues to warm, the real threat is that the permafrost, in fact, my relatives in Canada tell me, huge portions of the Canadian permafrost have disappeared. And, if that disappears, then these clathrates could be released to the atmosphere before anybody gets to mine them at all. And what that would do is pump carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And that's a far more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
Methane.
Pardon me, then. Yeah, methane. Far more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. That's the bad news. The good news is methane is not stable in the atmosphere. It is broken down by the ultraviolet radiation from the sun, and it's a light gas. It will eventually dissipate. However, the dissipation time is long, and so you wind up getting a few million year spike of warming.
I could outlive that.
So, but, and you know, these things have happened in the past. That's what scientists have pointed out. If you look back in the fossil record, we can see evidence that would sustain a clathrate crisis, where the clathrates got exposed and it pumped all this methane into the atmosphere and caused a significant global warming climate instability. Probably the most dramatic example would be the Eocene. That was about 50 million years ago, where it became so warm that Ellesmere Island, which is the northernmost of the Canadian islands, had no ice or snow, had an average temperature in the mid-50s. Year-round. So, and, you know, North America had no snow and no ice. But it was also a time where it caused the oceans to become oxygen depleted. And with the oxygen depletion of the oceans, that led to a bloom of these bacterial species that wound up pumping huge quantities of hydrogen sulfide in the atmosphere, which basically killed off all the large-bodied animals. And, you know, we're in that category. We are a large-bodied animal. And, you know, we cannot survive if there's even a tiny amount of hydrogen sulfide in the atmosphere. So, but that's true of other life forms as well. That's one reason why, by the way, your sense of smell is so sensitive to hydrogen sulfide. It is a deadly gas. But fortunately, we can sniff out even the tiniest amount of hydrogen sulfide, and it's such an unpleasant odor to the human nose that we quickly back away and go to a place where that doesn't exist. Yeah, it's the rotten egg smell.
But one question. I assume there's some around Greenland. You forgot Greenland on the map.
Yeah. Well, this is simply the place where they
found
it. They haven't looked everywhere.
No, they haven't looked on Greenland.
So, this is why most scientists believe that the higher estimate is likely to be correct rather than the lower estimate, because we've only done a little bit of exploration. But when I told you it's 1,350 trillion barrels of oil equivalent, that's only looking at the proven resources of these clathrates. You know, scientists believe there's much more than just that minimum number, because everywhere we've looked where it should exist, we find it. But we haven't looked everywhere. But I'd also argue it's unlikely to be as high as 500,000 trillion. I think a more realistic number would be somewhere between, say, 1 and 300,000 trillion barrels of oil equivalent. That's still a lot of methane. That's a huge amount of methane. And yes, if it ever got released to the atmosphere, that would be the end not only of human civilization, it would be the end of humanity. Because it would cause such a warming trend in the atmosphere that we would not survive. So that's one reason why some people are saying, don't touch this stuff. Because it's just too difficult to get it out of the ground without having consequences for the atmosphere. But there's other people who say, hey, let's keep doing the research, because if we can figure this thing out, it's going to give us a supply of fossil fuels far greater than anything conceivable with all the other sources combined. So, but as I mentioned last week, there is a prophecy in Revelation 16 that there will be a severe global warming event in the days just before the return of Jesus Christ to planet Earth to usher in the new creation where this universe and planet Earth God removes from existence, as he's spoken into existence. The text tells us he'll speak it out of existence, but not until he permanently and eternally conquers evil and suffering once and for all. But in the days just before that happens, it says humanity will bring upon itself the consequences of its mistakes in managing the planet for the benefit of all life. A command you see in Genesis 1, that we are to manage the resources of planet Earth not only for our own benefit, but for the benefit of all species of life. And if you look at Job 37, 38, and 39, you can check out the book over there on Job. It actually gives you a manual of instruction of how to manage the resources of the planet for the benefit of all life. But the book of Isaiah predicts that at the time of the end, we human beings, in our quest for wealth, will wind up losing our wealth because we will literally begin to pollute ourselves to death. And when you look at the 21 dooms that are predicted to fall upon humanity in the book of Revelation, 7 in Revelation 6, 7 in Revelation 8, and the final 7 in Revelation 16, many scholars have pointed out every single one of them is a catastrophe brought upon humanity by humanity's own mismanagement of the planet. In other words, it's not so much that God brings this upon the planet, we bring it upon ourselves. But in that context, we have the fourth bowl doom in Revelation 16, which tells us, let me read the text here. Let's see, here we go. I heard, wait a minute. The fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and the sun was given power to scorch people with fire. They were seared by the intense heat, and they cursed the name of God who had control over these plagues, but they refused to repent and glorify Him. Now, there's some Bible scholars who have looked at this text and say God's going to do something supernatural to the sun itself. I would argue that does not fit the context of the 21 disasters that are predicted in the book of Revelation, because if you actually look at all of them, it talks about, for example, how the sun light will be turned into blood or red like the blood of a corpse. And so it's referring to the fact that the image of the sun, moon, and stars will be severely reddened. And it's not that God reddens the sun, moon, and stars. What happens is it's talking about a dust problem in our atmosphere. If you pump lots of dust into the atmosphere, the impact is that the light of the blood of the sun, moon, and stars literally becomes red, and it becomes red like the blood of a corpse. So it's a very accurate description of what happens during a forest fire. And, you know, we've all lived here in Southern California. Those of us who have been here for more than a year or two realize that's exactly what happens when these hills catch fire, as it pumps dust in the atmosphere. And then when you look up at the sun, moon, and stars, they're red like the blood of a corpse. But what this text is saying, there will come a time when that'll be a worldwide event. It won't be just here in Southern California during the Santa Anas. It'll be worldwide. Yes, Ted.
What I notice in that whole text is there aren't any atheists at that time. They acknowledge God, but they curse Him.
Right.
So, interesting observation, isn't it?
Well, it's a reflection. A number of scholars have pointed out, we see here in these Revelation 6, 8, and 16, it's a lot like what you see in Exodus 3 through 11. Is that, you know, and the case of Exodus, it's God that steps in and brings these catastrophes upon these unbelieving Egyptians. And what you notice is the people who don't believe in God wind up believing in God. At the very, towards the end of the catastrophes, they acknowledge that it is God that's bringing these disasters upon them. At the beginning of the catastrophes, they were not giving God the credit. By the time you get to the end, they give God the credit. So you're very right, insightful there, that by the time you get to Revelation 16, there are no atheists, there are no agnostics. Everybody there believes in God, but there are a lot of people who don't like Him and insist on remaining in rebellion against Him.
My arm's 24 inches long. I could barely box a human.
So,
a losing fight.
Well, but the good news is this. What you notice in the book of Exodus is that the Egyptians were watching all this happening. And more they're coming to the recognition, this is God. And there are two responses on the part of the Egyptians. Those that curse God, and then those that said, we're going to join Him. And, you know, people have often critiqued Exodus because they said, there's no way that you could begin with 70 people. Those were the people that came into Egypt with Jacob and his family. There's no way those 70 people could propagate to 3.5 million in just a few hundred years. That's way too rapid of a human population growth. But what they fail to recognize is the book of Exodus tells us that when the children of Israel left the land of Egypt, many Egyptians and many foreigners living in Egypt joined them and became Jews. And so that explains why the numbers were as large as what they were. And this is the whole point. God's goal was to bring salvation to these Egyptians. And through these disasters, there were two responses. Those that cursed God and those that said we're going to join Him. And likewise, this is what's happening here in the book of Revelation. When you look at Revelation 6, not everybody's believing in God. By the time you get to Revelation 16, they all believe in God. And you basically are splitting humanity down into two categories. Those that say, we're going to join Him, and those that say, we're going to curse Him. But that's God's goal, to get you off the fence. And incidentally, He's doing that with every one of us. We all know people who are agnostics, who really don't know whether God exists or not. God's goal is to keep you alive here on planet Earth long enough that you're tipped off the fence, one way or the other. And you can talk to Pastor Anderson, who's been the pastor here for many years until just a few years ago when Paul took over. But I remember being on the staff with Dick, and he told me about the hundreds of times he had been with people on their deathbeds when they were completely lucid. And he said, I only saw two responses. Those that were experiencing tremendous joy for about what they were to receive and going across the threshold to the gates of heaven, and those that were cursing God as they were dying and just eager to get to hell where they could curse God for the rest of eternity. So they never saw anybody in the fence. They're in one category or the other. Now, not everybody dies in a lucid state, but he says those that did die in a lucid state, I got one response or the other. There wasn't any third alternative. And this is where Dick believes that indeed God has us here on planet Earth long enough to go one way or the other. We don't die in a state of ignorance. We actually make a choice. As it says in John chapter 1, God's light has gone out to every human being, every baby, every fetus, every teenager, every adult, every senior citizen. God's light's gone out to everyone. And if you receive that light, you will proceed towards salvation and your eternal reward in the kingdom of heaven. If you say no thank you to that light, then you proceed towards condemnation and a life of eternal separation from God with all the consequences that brings. And there's nobody who's kind of left saying, I don't know one way or the other. The promise is the light's gone out, and we're all held responsible for what we do with that light. Some of us get more light. Some of us get light in different ways from other people. But I would argue we all get light in different ways and in different amounts. But we will be judged according to what we decide to do with that light. In other words, it's a choice where you want to spend the rest of eternity. God does not send people to hell. People choose hell. Now, again, that's something I can tell you just from talking with Dick Anderson. He says these people that were cursing God as they were dying and heading for hell were going to the place that they exactly wanted to go. They looked at the kingdom of heaven as a place of greater torment than what they would experience in the lake of fire.
Can we say stupid?
Huh?
Can we say stupid?
It's not so much stupid. In fact, I would argue that the decision of the rebel is a conscious decision and rational in one context. The one who looks at God's authority and says, I do not want this man to rule over me. I want to go to a place where I don't have to submit to the authority of God. Well, God is a place for you where you'll never have to submit to His authority. Heaven is a place for people who want to submit to His authority. So again, people don't get sent to hell, they choose hell. People don't get sent to heaven, they choose heaven. It's a choice. But God keeps you here long enough to make sure that that choice is in place. Which explains why some of us live longer, some of us don't live so long.
So if you're indecisive, you live longer.
Well, no.
So about 120.
I'm not giving you any motivation here. Please don't get me, don't take me into context here. I'm not trying to give you motivation to stay undecided. Because after all, how does God get to the undecided? he gets to the undecided with people who've decided firmly to give their life to the authority of Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe, and then God uses that person to reach people who are in a state of doubt or uncertainty or questioning God's love, authority, and so forth. So often God will keep the righteous committed to him alive, literally for decades beyond their point of salvation, because God can use them as an instrument. And there are times where God looks at the righteous and says, you know what, if I keep you alive any longer, you're going to be facing so much torment and trauma, and I don't want you to go through that. I'm going to bring death to you early, because it's clear what you have decided, but knowing what exists later on in your future, I don't want you to have to go through that pain and trauma. I'm going to take you home early. And likewise, the same thing's true on the other side. There are times where somebody keeps someone who is in a state of rebellion against God or is in an undecided state and keeps them alive for 80, 90, 100 years. And you say, this person just isn't in a state of belief. Why is God keeping him alive that long? Because God's not giving up on that person. And so he realizes there's still hope. And so he will keep, quote, the rebel alive. And then you say, well, how come in some cases God brings death quickly to the rebel? Well, if the rebellion is firmly committed, then there's really no point from God's perspective in extending the life of the committed rebel. Why? Because all that's going to happen for that committed rebel is they're going to pile up more judgment against them when it comes to the great white throne judgment. And God says, in my great mercy, I'll bring death to you early so that you can go to a better place than the lake of fire rather than a place that's more tormenting.
There's hope for you, Al.
Sounds like they used to kill babies as soon as they were born, so they would be. So you go to heaven. That's your thing. And why have you?
Listen to what I said.
Born, what are you going to do? I'm not going to waste any time on you right now.
No. You missed what I said at the beginning. God sends out his light to every human being, every child, every teenager, every fetus. We are spiritual from the time that we are conceived, as it says in Psalm 51 and Psalm 139. We've looked at those texts. So from a biblical perspective, we are a spiritual being from the time that we're conceived. But we have the promise in John chapter 1 and John chapter 3 that his light literally goes out to every human being. Everyone has received light. And we're all held responsible to respond to that light. Now, if God knows that you're going to make it up into your 80s, he doesn't have to use a channel of communication like he would with a fetus. Because he knows you're going to be born, you're going to be educated, well-educated, and God can use those means to reach you with the knowledge of his truth.
That fetus has not heard about God.
He hasn't heard about God. No, hold it, Al. He hasn't heard about God the way you have heard about God. But he has heard about God. God's truth goes out to every human being. You might call it magic. Let me just give you a quick story. My younger sister became a Christian when she was in her 20s. But she wouldn't read her Bible. And she wouldn't go to church. She wouldn't go to a Bible study. And God spoke to her. I mean, I remember her calling me and she says, you know, it's so wonderful, this relationship I have with God, because he speaks to me in dreams and visions. And I kept saying, well, you know, maybe you could be reading the Bible and getting some good communication that way. Well, that wasn't happening. But after many years, she finally started to read her Bible, go to church, fellowship with God's people. And she called me on the phone and said, Hugh, I think something's wrong with my life. I'm not getting any dreams and visions anymore. And I said, that's a good thing that you're not getting dreams and visions.
That's the answer to the fetus. He can have a vision or a dream while he's still in the
I don't know what happens when that fetus is in the water bag, Al. I mean, I'm using the dream kind of again. Here's my sister. She was in her 40s getting these dreams and visions, right?
Yeah, well, come on and go to hell. I mean, that's what Catholic Church said, limbo and purgatory and all these other things.
I'm not a Roman Catholic, Al.
I know, but what are they going to do? Are they going to go straight to hell, or what are they going to do?
No, you're bringing up a really good doctrinal point. And by the way, it's not just Roman Catholics. I know a number of Protestants, as well as Eastern Orthodox, who believe in what's called the age of accountability. That if a human being dies before the age of accountability, which is defined as the age where a human being can understand the plan of salvation through the written scriptures or through a preacher explaining it to them through some kind of church sermon.
Is that like a bar mitzvah?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the bar mitzvah idea. And you notice in Roman Catholicism, they also have this ceremony when they hit age 16.
Confirmation.
Yeah, confirmation. Well, that's kind of comes from this idea that there's this age of accountability. And so if you die before the age of accountability, 13 of you are Jews, 16 of you are Roman Catholic, 10 of you are Protestant, so I guess it's better to be a Roman Catholic. Obviously, we can tell a lot of jokes here. But the whole point is, if you die before that magic age, then you automatically go to heaven. And so this kind of raises the conundrum. Well, then wouldn't it be better if we just simply, in fact, people have given that as an excuse for abortions. Why are we condemning abortions if the fetus automatically goes to heaven? We who are Christians should be thrilled that, you know, millions of babies are being aborted because they automatically go to heaven. Well, that's one reason why I think the doctrine of the age of accountability is biblically incorrect. Because I look at passages like John 1 and John 3, which tell us God's light's gone out to every human being. And it doesn't tell us how, but it's quite clear, just from the story I told about my sister and what we see here in the Bible itself, God's got multiple ways of getting his light through to us. In fact, we have this institution across the street called Klein. It's an institution for people who have multiple handicaps. And many of the people there are very severely mentally retarded and blind, or severely mentally retarded and deaf. Not all of them are mentally retarded, but the whole point is we've personally seen people there who are 50 years of age with very severe mental retardation. And yet as we spend Sunday after Sunday with them, it becomes quite clear they have a relationship with Jesus Christ. Even though they can't read a word of the Bible, even though they have difficulty understanding when anybody's communicating to them through spoken speech, but everything about their lifestyle tells us they have a relationship with Jesus Christ.
Whatever, you're totally insane.
Pardon me?
And totally insane. Say you have Alzheimer's, and you've never heard of God. So how is God going to get to them through a vision or a dream? Maybe he can. I don't know.
Well, okay, we are body, soul, and spirit. And our brain...
It's no spirit, that's a spirit. Right?
Yeah, the brain is, think of it as a piece of hardware, because that's really what it is. It's a whole bunch of neurons and synapses, and you've got other components in there, chemicals, etc. It's an interface between your physical body and your spirit. And so we get the idea that if the hardware is crippled, the spirit is crippled. That's not how God sees it. Because when you die, your brain becomes totally useless. But according to the Bible, you continue to live. Okay? Your spirit is intact. And eventually you get a new piece of hardware.
Oh, that's it. I got to become a Christian.
Well, what we're getting down to is a debate. Are we physicalists? I mean, when I was debating the atheists at the Skeptic Society, a lot of them are physicalists, which means they believe that we human beings are no different than bacteria. We're no different than rocks. We're just purely physical matter. Christians, in fact, anybody who believes in God, you don't have to be a Christian, Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims believe this as well, is that we human beings have a dual nature. We have a physical body, in addition to her physical body, there's a soul and a spirit. Now, some Christians believe that what's called the trichotomy, that the soul and the spirit are separate from one another. Most Bible scholars believe that the soul and the spirit are inseparable, which is the idea that we're a dual nature. When you die, your soul and spirit remain intact. You lose the hardware, but your soul and spirit continue to live on. Now, if that's really true, it's immaterial how crippled your brain is in terms of receiving light from God. God can communicate spirit to spirit. He doesn't need the brain. He doesn't need our physical hardware.
Soul and spirit are the same, aren't they? I mean, it's an invisible thing, like air or something. So
it is invisible, right?
Invisible, and you can't prove they're there. Nobody's ever measured them, nobody's ever seen them. So that is where faith comes in, I know. But for me, that's a big leap.
Well, it shouldn't be a big leap, because there's scientific experiments you can perform to show that the duality of human beings must be true. That's something I spoke about in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, as there's actually scientific experiments that have been done literally right here in Southern California.
To test the spirit, the soul?
To test the spirit and the soul.
I've read about those too. They come out negative. They can't win.
No, I'm not talking about, because by definition, the soul and spirit are not physical.
Okay.
But if they're not physical and they're real, they should have some measurable effect on the way we respond to physical reality. And so what people have done is they've done experiments with lower life forms compared to higher life forms. So higher life forms that the Bible tells us are not only physical, they're also soulish. Birds, mammals, and the higher reptiles. So they've done experiments to see if there's a measurable difference between the way these creatures behave and respond to their environment and all the other life forms. And then a second set of experiments where they measure how these higher animals relate to their environment and we human beings relate to our environment.
How are they measured? What kind of instruments do they use?
Well, it's not the kinds of instruments that we astrophysicists use. But what they would do, in fact, I tell a kind of a cute story in the book about how a lot of this research was done through YouTube. People literally looked at tens of thousands of video clips of animal behavior and then said, hey, given that we got tens of thousands of video clips, this is statistically significant. Let's see what we can learn.
And cat videos was included in that research?
I actually had graduate students in teams who were spending nothing but looking at YouTube videos and categorizing them, classifying them, and giving them to their professors, and they wrote the research papers and got all the fame. But it was literally the hard work of dozens of graduate students that made all that possible. Anyway, I tell a story in the book about how they recognize that, for example, birds and mammals really are highly motivated to reach out to a higher being, namely us human beings, and how they will relate to us in a way they never relate to one another. There's actually a measurable distinction in the way these creatures would relate to us as opposed to one another. And how if you take away the abuse factor, you actually see that motivation far more strongly expressed than without that factor. And, you know, we're all honest. We actually see that with a lot of our pets. They literally do anything they can to please you. And so we respond to them in an appropriate way and don't abuse them. You actually see that being motivated well. But likewise, they're able to show that we human beings are different and that we, too, have this motivation to reach out to something beyond ourselves, just like these animals have this motivation to reach out beyond themselves. And then if you look at how the spirit is defined, there's a moral imperative in the spirit of human beings. Now, if this is something that we got from the lower life forms through evolution, we should see evidence for that moral imperative in the animals. So they've actually done experiments to see if we can see, for example, that dogs experience sin like we human beings experience sin. A lot of people thought they were seeing it, but there was a group of researchers at Boston University who said, no, you're doing the experiments the wrong way. Let's actually do these experiments where we can take the human owner effect out, because her point was, the researcher, is that dogs, for example, are so highly motivated to please their human owners, they will do things that look like moral behavior just to please the human owners. So what they did is they took the human owner out of the equation and used inanimate objects and discovered they got the same behavior, which means it had nothing to do with morality at all. And how they actually had a research study done on what's called the guilty look phenomena. Any of you who've had a dog have seen this? How dogs look guilty when they do something bad. And so people have looked at that and said, well, it means they're moral creatures. No, they know that if they look guilty, it's going to make you happy. That they have that guilty look. And they actually did sophisticated experiments to show it doesn't matter what the dog did. If the human owner is expecting a guilty look, the dog will put on a guilty look regardless of whether it did anything good or bad. It's all there to please the human owner.
Isn't that just a, like wolves, you know, have an order when they're out there, and they always have an
alpha dog.
Alpha dog.
Yeah.
And they all come up there and they bow their heads, you know, when they come around them. I think that's the same thing with humans. I think when you threaten them a little bit like that, or you, even with a voice, you know, they bow their heads and say, yeah, you know, you're bigger than I am, or you're my master.
Well, what these experiments are showing, this isn't unique to dogs. You actually see the same kind of behavior in other animals that are capable of strong emotional bonds with a human being. The thing that's special about dogs is that they have a capability of facial expression that's really unique to the species of dogs. So they can, I mean, you can actually train a dog to smile when it's happy. They don't do that in the wild. In fact, when they smile, it's usually a sign of a threat, right? But they quickly figure out, oh, my master likes me to smile when I'm happy, so I'll do that just to make my master happy.
What's with cats? Are they autistic?
Yeah, cats aren't great on facial expressions, but dogs are. And matter of fact, it's partly our fault. We've actually bred the dogs to be more facially expressive than they otherwise would be in the wild. So, in fact, I was joking a few weeks ago, we're actually now breeding dogs to be clothing tolerant. Dogs in the wild hate wearing clothes, but we're actually now breeding dogs to be clothing tolerant because there's all these ladies out there who like to put these frilly things on their dogs. So people are actually breeding dogs to be able to tolerate. And again, the dog will do whatever it takes to please its owner. Hey, if I got to wear this silly thing, I'll do it just to make you feel good. Yes.
How would you describe, if I know that biblical Christianity says spirit, I mean body and soul, two natures for a human. But since the dogs or these other soulish animals, do they have a dual nature also? Or how would you separate that?
They do. However, and again, this is controversial within the Christian community. Does that mean that because they are body and they have soulish features, not to the degree that we do, but they do have mind, will, and emotions, and they have this desire to nurture and relate and to reach out to a higher species, does that mean that they'll go to heaven? Well, from my perspective, the Bible is quite clear that heaven and hell are only for spiritual beings, which means that these animals, as much as we enjoy and love them, will not be with us in heaven. So I know I get more negative mail by just saying that than anything else I say in the Ministry of Reasons to Believe. But let me also add this. I'm not saying there won't be animals in heaven. It just won't be the animals you have here. God never takes anything away from us without giving us something better. No, we won't be angels. There'll be angels in the new creation, and there'll be human beings. And it says God's going to elevate us human beings to be above the angels. Right now we're lower than the angels, but a time will come when we'll be above the angels. If you want to know why, the angels watch the grace of God. We human beings directly experience the grace of God. We're being trained in a way that they're not. And you might say, why does God take us through so much suffering in this life? The angels don't go through it. You know, they get off scot-free. But we're the beneficiaries of all that suffering, because that suffering is training us to enjoy a career for the rest of eternity. So why complain about 50, 70, 80, 90, 100 years worth of suffering based on what it's going to do for you for the rest of eternity? The angels, we should feel sorry for them. They don't get to experience all this stuff.
The angels are going to be serving us, according to Billy Graham. They're going to be serving us.
Well, they'll be serving us. And by the way, if you go to the book of Hebrews, it tells us even now they serve us. They're the ones that are assisting God's servants in their ministry of bringing the good news of Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. And frankly, I think we see evidence of that all the time. I think I see evidence of that.
Wow.
Here's how. Okay. 1 Peter 3:15. I've got to get back to the age of accountability. You guys are getting me off track. But here's how. 1 Peter 3:15 and 16. Always be ready to give sound reasons for the hope within you with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. And if you will do that, prepare good reasons, God will use His angels and other supernatural means to bring people across your path that are ready to receive those good reasons and respond and give their life to Christ. And I know many of you here have seen examples of that, where no, I can tell you one story. I think I told already here in the class. I got on an airplane and I got bumped up to first class. I've only flown first class twice in my life. And I got to sit beside a German atheist quantum physicist who likewise never flies first class, but he was being sent in as a consultant to Microsoft and they insisted on giving him a first class seat. Now, what are the odds that a Christian astrophysicist who never flies first class would sit beside a German quantum physicist atheist who never flies first class, whose big issue is about the existence of God? As he says, if God exists, why is the universe so big? Why is it so old? Why is it so decayed? I mean, he was literally asking me the questions that were the chapter outline of my book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. Again, what are the odds that he'd be sitting right beside the author of that book, okay?
Blind chance.
You could say it's blind chance, but if it happens to you 1,000 times over the course of a couple of years, it can't be blind chance.
So you're saying an angel sitting on your shoulder?
I don't know whether it was an angel or what, but we do have a story in the book of Acts where Philip, one of the seven deacons, was sent to the Ethiopian eunuch in the chariot. And here is the Ethiopian eunuch reading the book of Isaiah and not understanding what he was reading. And suddenly there's Philip right beside him. God supernaturally translated Philip to be right beside the Ethiopian eunuch. Philip explained to him what these texts in Isaiah were all about. He says, this is not about the prophet, it's about the coming Messiah. And I got good news for you. The Messiah has already come. And then he explained the whole story of what the ministry about the ministry of Jesus. And what was the response of the Ethiopian eunuch? Here is some water. Why can't I get baptized right now? And so literally that day, he gave his life to Christ. And the moment he got baptized, what happened to Philip? He got translated back. So I'm not saying that's the way God does it every time. Sometimes he just puts us on airplanes together. Sometimes he puts you in a grocery line together. Sometimes he puts you in a postal office line together. But God does that. He says, why does God do that? It says the workers are few. Because the workers are few, which means that there's only a few that have prepared sound reasons for the hope within them and are prepared to present those reasons with gentleness and respect. And because there's only a few, God uses His angels and other means to supernaturally bring these people together as a way to spread the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ. And a promise I can give to every one of you, if you will prepare good reasons and present those good reasons in a Christian attitude, you will see these kinds of miracles in your life. You can talk to our people at our Reasons to Believe staff. They've all experienced this. You can experience it too. It's a guaranteed way to have miracles happen in your life. And I would say those are greater miracles than raising somebody physically from the dead or healing them from cancer. Why? Because those few minutes you spent with them is going to give them an eternal reward in the new creation. That's the greatest miracle of all, and that's a miracle God is committed to bring into your life. Now, before I answer any more questions.
No more questions or comments.
Okay. I got to get back to the age of accountability, because I see this as a major doctrinal problem and issue within the church. And as I said before, based on John 1 and John 3, I don't think there is an age of accountability. I believe that God's light actually gets through to every human being, the severely retarded, the fellow who is suffering from Alzheimer's disease, the fetus in the womb, that, you know, what we're looking at are examples of people who lack the necessary hardware to receive the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ, say through reading this book. But God is God. He's a spiritual being. Each one of us are spiritual beings. And it tells us in this book that He is capable of communicating spirit to spirit, independent of the physical hardware. And where the physical hardware is missing, He will use those means of communication. Where it's not missing, He's going to use normal means of communication. So just like the story about my younger sister, the moment she started reading the Bible, that was the end of her dreams and visions, which is a good thing. God was now using the normal means of communication to get through rather than the supernatural means, which again is another reason why we shouldn't be chasing after miracles. God would much rather have us experience these things through natural means of communication channels. But the whole point is, given that the hardware is not necessary, we can really believe what it says in John 1 and John 3. God's light goes out to every human being. And if that human being receives that light, they will proceed to salvation and justification of their sins. If that human being rejects that light, they proceed towards condemnation. And what I said in the beginning, you get to choose where you spend the rest of eternity. That's true for all of us here in the class. It's also true for a fetus that's only 3 weeks old in the womb. It's also true for someone who's so severely retarded that they're not able to read scripture or listen to a sermon. Or to someone who has Alzheimer's who's not able to communicate with the outside world. They can't communicate with you, but they can communicate with God. Now, I know that for a fact because I've had relatives on my wife's side of the family who had died of severe dementia. And what I noticed is they reached a point where they couldn't communicate with us. They couldn't recognize. I mean, my wife's mother got to a point where she couldn't recognize her own daughter or her own husband. But you could read to her out of this book and she would respond. Or you could sing a hymn and she would respond. Those are the last forms of communication that she was able to respond to. So she didn't know who we were, couldn't talk to us, couldn't hear anything we said. But when we began to read scripture or sing a hymn, there was a response. That was the last thing to go in their lives. And you see the face change too. Huge smile would break out upon their face. So it tells me the hardware was missing and largely gone, but the spirit was still alive. It was undiminished in every respect. So, and I remember Kathy's grandmother, and she died of severe dementia. But everybody in the hospital there said they just loved going into her room. So they said when we walk into her room, there's a glow that just permeates the whole room and it makes us feel good. And she had walked with the Lord for over 60 years. And I remember walking into her room, same thing happened to me. I mean, she'd walked with the Lord so consistently that here she was on her deathbed, her brain almost totally gone. And yet there was real spiritual communication going on between her and me and obviously between her and God. So in that sense, I think they had it wrong when they said, let's kill all of the babies because it's automatically going to send them all to heaven. No. They've had God's light, and they will go to heaven, and they will go to hell according to their own choosing, just like the rest of us. So, with that, I'm going to say a word of prayer, because I got to try to catch an airplane. But let's just let the class rates go, and we'll move on into the rest of human origins. Kind of where I want to take you on this is getting into what the biblical text actually says about Adam and Eve, and then move on into some of the challenges that we see scientifically we get into a date for Adam and Eve, how do we date human origins through scientific means, and how to respond to the scientific challenges, particularly coming through the study of human genomics. Father in heaven, we want to thank you, Lord, not only for giving us a brain that's able to act as a piece of hardware, an interface between our spirit and the real world, but also, Lord, that you put us alive here in the 21st century where there's just so much knowledge abounding. And Father, I pray that we would not become so fascinated with all this new knowledge that's coming upon us, but actually see this as something that's revealing more and more about you, your character, and your plan of salvation for the human race, and your plan of salvation for each one of us as individuals. Help us, Lord, as we respond to all this burgeoning knowledge that is pouring upon us in these last days. Help us to receive more and more of your life, your truth, and love on a daily basis. In Jesus' name, amen.